Well, this is exciting, little children. Today, it's April 2nd, 2023. The time is 17:36 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green here with you again. Today, the Wild Road article is also along with the chapter in Genesis, is on the study agenda. I was showing this document here a moment ago. I must have clicked on something there. Not sure why that came up to the top, but the Insight book from 1988, this is the document that I have open here. It defines the region of Seir as the mountainous region between the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba. And if we look on this map here, on the lower left, you see the Gulf of Aqaba near the town of Aqaba. That's the body of water, the Gulf. And then we have the Dead Sea is near Jerusalem here. That's the Dead Sea, that whole body of water. And that's, according to the scale, 100 kilometers shows also it's equal to 62 miles. So about 60 miles for that scale length. So we would go maybe 60 from the Gulf of Aqaba upwards to about here. And then another to about Petra, perhaps. Slightly shy of Petra, and then we go another 60 miles. It would be about 120 miles between the Gulf of Aqaba and the Dead Sea, very roughly. So that's for our study in Genesis, so that we understand that. Another thing I should mention is when Jacob was traveling south from Haran, he came into the mountainous region of Gilead, which is right about somewhere up north here of north of Jerusalem and east of Jerusalem, somewhere in the region of this little body of water here, which is the Sea of Galilee. But somewhere in this region is the mountainous region of Gilead. So we see there's another 60 or more miles to get from there to the southern tip of the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea. So there's a lot of miles to travel to get from, well, the 500 miles, first of all, that Jacob had to travel from Haran to the mountainous region of Gilead, and then another, I'm not even certain where the mountainous region of Gilead is on this map. I'm not certain about it. It's somewhere in this area. So, somewhere in that area. I believe it's, this is, yeah, I think it's right. That's correct, because it's supposed to be the northwestern part of Jordan. This is the country of Jordan being shown on this map. So that is, I believe, where Jacob met Laban, right in this upper left projection there on the map, where all the towns are shown. Near the town of Erbid, for example, on this map, or Dara, somewhere in that region. And then Jacob would have had to have traveled all the way down somewhere to the region south of the Dead Sea. Now, maybe that's because he couldn't cross the Jordan directly, because we remember that the Israelites couldn't cross the Jordan unless Jehovah had parted it, which he did. He parted the Jordan River. He stopped up the Jordan River and caused the water in the Jordan River to just vanish away and stopped flowing so that the Israelites could cross in the days of Joshua. So that was a period of time that was actually quite a bit later, more like 1452 BCE, whereas Jacob is coming here after the birth of Joseph, so it's about 1950. Well, Joseph would have been grown up too, so it would be sometime around, or he'd be grown partly up, maybe he was 8 years old or 6 years old or something, I think. Well, 20 years they mentioned, didn't they? They mentioned 20 years so that Laban had been dealing with Jacob for 20 years. That was mentioned, so that means Joseph was 6 years old. So that's about right, so he'd be able to travel at that age. So 6 years old, in the year 1953 minus 6, which is 1947 BCE, that would be when Jacob was coming here, which is almost 500 years earlier, before the time of Joshua. But at that time, it's interesting that he went all the way down to the land where Esau lived here before he crossed over the valley, the valley of the Arabah, or the Salt Sea, and then he went back north to Shechem after that, or wherever Shechem is on this map. He had to go this way and not cross over first, apparently. Or he chose to go that route, but it would have been possibly... I'm wondering if it was out of his way at all to go that direction. But of course, we know that Abraham lived somewhere in the southern part of Israel, in the Negev almost, or he lived part of the time in the Negev, as did Isaac too. They moved around. They were shepherds. Anyway, so let's come back to our study for today in the Wild Road article. Shall we, little children? It's paragraph 5, chapter 5, I should say, paragraph 7. The continued startling success of the Blessed Genealogy with regard to its ability to include the Bible in history, which is the long-sought Holy Grail. That's paragraph 5, 7. That's what we've already read yesterday. Okay. Now we're going to continue with paragraph 5, 8. And because that was relevant to understanding the context, so it's good that we read that. We won't have time to consider every corrupted version of chronology ever created. And our chronology is basically the only one. It's the only uncorrupted chronology. But it is instructive that there were numbers given in the book of Sothis. It can be shown, and I've talked about this before, that these numbers in the book of Sothis agree with Abraham's dating in the Blessed Genealogy, and that the book of Sothis, the number 700 in the book of Sothis, combined with 511 years of shepherd kings in Josephus, counted from Peleg's year 5 in the book of Sothis, which is 2745 in the Blessed Genealogy. That's a total of 700 plus 511 is 1211, is it not? And then we have that number 1211 subtracted from 2745, which gives 1534 BCE, a year prior to the expulsion of the Hyksos, as is stated elsewhere in the Crucible of Credible Creed and in Trojan War, as we see in the footnotes below. Not only that, but the 700 years themselves end in the year 2045 of the Blessed Genealogy, 1 year prior to the BG birth of Jacob, when the first dynasty of Egypt is 228 years. Eusebius gives that number as from Manetho, and is followed by 215 years of Arab kings of Jackson's Babylonian sequence, we get 2302 as the start of the dynasty of Akkad, as already allowed. These are some of the few numbers which add up neatly in the Blessed Genealogy. One of the beauties of the Akkadian dynasty start date being near this time is that it puts Naram-Sin as king very near or just after the birth of Abraham, and also causes the alignment with Chedorlaomer at Akkad's end. The great fame of Naram-Sin fits his identification as Nimrod or Ninus by some later commentators on Abraham. People do confuse Nimrod with Naram-Sin, and this is very neatly explained in the Blessed Genealogy, which is our chronology, because the chronology of the BG allows us to place Naram-Sin as being king very near the time of the birth of Abraham. And it still allows Gudea or Ninus or Chedorlaomer, as he's also called in the Bible in Genesis chapter 14, to be active and very dominant as a military presence right at the time when Abraham was living in the promised land of Canaan, or what later became the promised land of Canaan, because it was promised to him, of course, many times, or at least the promise was repeated, it would appear, on at least two occasions, or three occasions, or it was repeated a number of times to Abraham, this promise. And also it was repeated to his offspring, of course, to Isaac and to Jacob. So that's it for this paragraph for today, but it shows the remarkable success and the brilliance of the simplicity of the Blessed Genealogy in terms of the ability that it has, our chronology has, to establish a reasonable explanation for historical and even other accounts of history, such as the more legendary accounts that put Naram-Sin as the person of Nimrod, for example. So, and also the people who put Nimrod as living in the time of Abraham, when actually Nimrod lived much before Abraham, some 500 years prior to the birth of Abraham, in fact. So we see that because they could call Naram-Sin Nimrod, based on his resembling in some ways Nimrod, in one way, of course, his name, Naram, and Nimrod and Naram being similar. So for that reason, they could be confused enough to say that Abraham lived at the time of Nimrod, which is not correct, of course, because Abraham didn't live at the Tower of Babel. That occurred many generations prior to Abraham, as the Bible clearly indicates. So there's no doubt about that part of it, that Nimrod lived long before Abraham. It's just that that is not always recognized by some of these other accounts of history, which are more legendary or mythological. And but we can explain them all just simply by understanding the correct chronology. It's the success that we have when we have correct, true chronology, when we get the true chronology. This is a very big, very important thing, and we call it the Blessed Genealogy. It also spells BG, which is like the word big. So it's a very big thing. So Genesis chapter 33. Now we know in chapter 32, Jacob had prepared to meet Esau. He'd struggled with the angel and so on. He received his new name, Israel. And in chapter 33, what we read now, little children. In time, Jacob raised his eyes and looked, and here Esau was coming, and with him 400 men. Consequently, he divided off the children to Leah and Rachel and to the two maidservants, and he put the maidservants and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after them, and Rachel and Joseph to the rear of them. And he himself passed on ahead of them and proceeded to bow down to the earth 7 times until he got near to his brother. And Esau went running to meet him, and he began to embrace him and fall upon his neck and kiss him. And he burst into tears. Then he raised his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are these with you?" To which he said, "The children with whom God has favored your servant." At that the maidservants came forward, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah, too, came forward and her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came forward and Rachel, and they bowed down. He now said, "What do you mean by all this camp of travelers that I have met?" To this he said, "In order to find favor in the eyes of my Lord." Then Esau said, "I have a great many, my brother. Let continue yours what is yours." However, Jacob said, "No, please. If now I have found favor in your eyes, then you must take my gift at my hand, because in harmony with its purpose I have seen your face as though seeing God's face, in that you received me with pleasure. Take, please, the gift conveying my blessing, which was brought to you, because God has favored me and because I have everything." And he continued to urge him so that he took it. Later on he said, "Let us pull out and go, and let me go in advance of you." But he said to him, "My Lord is aware that the children are delicate, and sheep and cattle that are giving suck are in my charge. And should they drive them too quickly for one day, then the whole flock will certainly die. Let my Lord please pass on ahead of his servant, but may I myself continue the journey at my leisure, according to the pace of the livestock that is before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I shall come to my Lord at Seir." Then Esau said, "Let me please put at your disposal some of the people who are with me." To this he said, "Why this? Let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord." So on that day Esau turned back on his way to Seir. And Jacob pulled out for Succoth, and he proceeded to build himself a house, and for his herd he made booths. That was why he called the name of the place Succoth. In time, Jacob came safe and sound to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. While he was coming from Paddan Aram, and he pitched camp in front of the city. Then he acquired a tract of the field where he pitched his tent at the hand of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money. After that he set up there an altar and called it God the God of Israel, or, in the footnote, God is the God of Israel. The name of the altar that Jacob set up there near the city of Shechem, in front of that city where he had acquired a tract of land from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. So that's it for today's study, little children. I wanted to talk about my watch straps that I was talking about yesterday, and about the memorial too. The memorial's coming, so that's a more important matter, of course, to consider about preparing for that. So even if one person is going to celebrate the memorial by themselves and they're not planning to partake of the emblems because they hope to live forever on earth and they don't want to go to heaven, they would still be quite right if they wanted to prepare the emblems, and they could still pass the emblem symbolically to themselves, and they could decline to take the emblems, pass the bread first, and then pass the unleavened bread, that is, and then pass the juice or whatever is being used to substitute for the blood of Christ. The blood means the new covenant in the scriptures, as Jesus said. Because of the blood that was poured out of his. But this is for the people of the heavenly calling to partake of the bread and the symbolic blood of Christ. So the body and the body of Christ symbolically is what the bread is, and the symbolic blood of Christ is then the liquid that's being used as the emblem representing that blood of Christ. But the person who is alone can decline to take the bread and can decline to take the wine, but can pass the plate or the cup to themselves and then place it down again. And then after the ceremony is all completed, when they've done considering whatever scriptures or whatever talks online they're going to watch from the governing body, or for example, Brother Hurd has given a very fine talk online. It's available on the JW.org website, and it's for April 4th. It's the memorial talk, and you can perhaps consider that talk as one of your matters to consider during the memorial service that you hold, if you hold it alone. And then at the end of all of your service, you can do what you want with the emblems, whether you want to eat the bread or consume whatever emblems were not used. You can do that, right? So that's it for the memorial discussion, little children. Now, I wanted to explain my new watch strap. I was going to say, I've got NATO straps one that came with the Vostok, but now I'm wearing the Vostok watch on a steel bracelet, one of the steel bracelets that I ordered separately, and it's just not as critical. But the NATO straps, this is the Vostok strap, I'm using it to mount the watch Hammy Crow, the name that I've given to my Hamilton watch, Hammy Crow. And because if one of the pins should fall out or break on a NATO strap like this, where the strap was all the way under the watch, I won't lose, you know, in this case, if one of these pins broke on the metallic bracelet that I have on the Vostok, the watch would fall off my wrist. On a NATO strap, if one of the pins is lost, the watch hangs on the other pin, hopefully long enough for the person wearing it to take it off the wrist and put it in their pocket. This watch is worth a lot more than the Vostok watch, so it's on a NATO strap for the reason that it's more than slightly, it's considerably more safe. It's considerably safer and better protected against loss. There are various reasons why metal straps are good too. If the buckle broke on a cloth strap, perhaps you could lose that watch. Whereas on a metallic bracelet, if the latch breaks, it's just going to be loose on your wrist. So metallic bracelets are somewhat more secure. Security is the word, I think, rather than safety, that I should have used to describe the security of the NATO strap. And I'm wearing these two watches today. Something I learned. So my other new strap is a 5-link bracelet. This is a 3-link. 3 links across. The new bracelet is 5 links, but I wasn't able to get it adjusted to fit both wrists. Whereas for this watch, I can wear it on either wrist. I can find the adjustment of it is using the holes in the strap. Whereas a metallic bracelet, you have to do some other adjustment to make it fit, and that adjustment involves either adding or removing links or a micro fine adjustment, which this strap doesn't have. But this strap fits actually both of my arms, actually, but only with the Vostok, because the lug to lug distance on the watch determines partly how big the strap is in terms of circumference. So this particular watch works with this strap on either my left or my right wrist. So the Vostok is well suited to this particular watch strap, and it has no actual microfine adjustment, but it just happened to work. So the watch strap, part of the watch buying experience, is a huge part of it. You have to get a watch strap that works as well. So I have two extra metallic watch straps right now, which I have not implemented because I put the Swiss watches, which is Hammy Crow and Live Dusty, my two Swiss watches, both on NATO straps. The other NATO strap I purchased separately, and I'm glad I did, because it's very good to have that security with the other Swiss watch, which I call Live Dusty. So this is Ward Green. It's April 2nd, 2023. It's 18:03 hours. And for Hammy Crow and Live Dusty, bye for now.